From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The film scholar Daryl Larson says it was 1975 when the comedy troupe Monty Python started thinking about a film set in the time of the New Testament. Larson says this was a millennial time with prophets and healers, and the Pythons wanted to say something about it. The working title for the film at first was Monty Python and the Life of Christ. They imagined characters in it like Ron the Baptist. But at some point, they shifted away from focusing on the life of an actual Jesus to a man who had been mistaken for him, Brian. Today in the program, Daryl Larson is joining us to talk about the book he's written about the life of Brian. It's about religious zealotry and terrorism, of course, but it's also as much about the British Empire as the Roman one. And it's one of the funniest things you'll ever see. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Yes, the 1979 film Monty Python's Life of Brian is a send-up on religious zealotry and terrorism. And it is hysterical to see the credulous masses following a very reluctant Brian as he becomes a very reluctant martyr for a very vague cause. But the film scholar Daryl Larson says Life of Brian might be set in first century Jerusalem, but it's as much about the colonial and political regime of the British Empire as the Roman one. If you think about the time the film opened, the UK in the late 1970s, where you had inflation and Thatcherism and striving leftists, the Life of Brian will make even more sense and probably be even more funny. Larson has written another book in his series on Monty Python films. This time, he pays assiduous attention to pretty much every moment in the life of Brian, and today in the program, he's joining us to talk about it. The book is a book about the film Monty Python's Life of Brian, all the references from Assyrians to Zeffirelli. Daryl Larson is a professor in the Media Arts Department and the Center for Animation at Brigham Young University. The author of a number of books on Monty Python here already, and he's joining us here in the studio. And Professor Larson, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
So when did it naturally follow that you would do a book about Life of Brian? I mean, you did one on the Holy Grail.
I suppose it should have naturally followed, but I just finished doing the Holy Grail book and probably wasn't interested in doing any new book. I came on your show, talked about the book.
Right.
You asked me about the next book.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm not interested. A few weeks later, I realized I actually was interested, and I probably would have been interested anyway, and got started on it. And that was, what, 2.5 years ago, and here we are.
Yeah. Let me ask you about where does Life of Brian fit in, like, in the Monty Python canon, and but also just in general. I mean, this seems to me, like, I guess I'm interested in how it compares, I suppose, to Holy Grail in terms of, like, what you think and others think of it. I mean, it seems even more a kind of spot-on classic, maybe. What do you think it is?
It is. I've always thought that it is Monty Python's most complete film. Yeah. It has a beginning, a middle, and end. It has a narrative arc that we can follow. There's a character we follow all the way through. With the exception of the spaceship, for example, there are fewer narrative eruptions that are outside of the world of the film.
Right.
So it's much more like a complete film, much more than Holy Grail, which was a series of connected, funny, but connected sketches.
Yeah.
And, of course, Meaning of Life would be their following film, which is also a series of
sketches that
are loosely connected. So this one is, frankly, their most complete film. It's probably their most committed film because they're asking questions about this is just prior to Thatcherism. So they're asking questions about what's happening as Jim Callaghan is the prime minister, and we're seeing inflation ratchet up and the world is changing and there's things blowing up everywhere and everything's being hijacked, it seems, at this time. A challenging time.
Quite literally.
Yes. And then we see, of course, they approach all of these things in a film that's ostensibly about first century Judea, but turns out to be just as much about 1978 Great Britain.
Yeah. It's interesting. It seems like, I think, and this was my impression, until I really started thinking about it and looking through your book, is that it seemed like it's a send up about religious zealotry more than anything else. I hadn't noticed the political and economic part of it.
Right. It certainly is about religious zealotry, and that's probably the easiest to identify. It's sort of, they wear that on their sleeve throughout the film. But there's so many references to employment, to jobs, to being able to get along. If you're an ex-leper, for example, then you have no trade anymore. You've lost
right.
your opportunity to support yourself.
Right.
If you're selling beards, if you're selling gourds, you're haggling for those kinds of things. There's a significant number of references to the economy. So those are kind of hard to avoid if you're looking at the film as closely as I like to look at those films. And they seem to come right from the pages of newspapers of the day. There's book after book and article after article written after about 1975 that are asking or actually calling for or reminding audiences that Britain is collapsing and that it's falling to pieces and that whoever's in charge is doing it wrong. And that's all before Margaret Thatcher and friends entered number 10.
They were in the wings.
They were waiting and making strides and making lots of noise. And the sitting Labour government wasn't helping themselves, but also the active trade unions who were very active about making sure that their pay packet demands were met. And those skyrocketed over time. None of that helped. And, of course, international monetary problems and OPEC challenges during this period, oil embargoes, et cetera, et cetera. It all sort of conspired into this kind of perfect storm.
You got a sense that, looking at the film, that the Pythons were frustrated with the kind of inept way the left was managing or mismanaging things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. At least a couple of the Pythons, at least, for example, Palin and Jones, we could probably call far left, if you will, extreme left, left of Harold Wilson, left of Jim Callaghan. Certainly left of any of the Thatcherites, and perhaps left of people like Cleese, who's also part of the troop, because they disagreed significantly about who should be running the country. Jones would have been fascinated, would have loved it if Tony Benn, for example, the sort of radical far-left firebrand, if he was given an opportunity to run the country. Mm-hmm. And Cleese, they said, just sort of almost had a fit when he heard that from them. So they were very different, actually, in their approaches, but they were certainly all left of center.
I want to play a moment that I've always been really fascinated by this. This was in November of 1979, after the film had come out. And there was a television program in Great Britain, and this particular one was hosted by Tim Rice.
Right.
And it was a debate. Set this up for us, because this is fascinating. There's a debate between the Pythons, two of the Pythons, mm-hmm. Cleese and Michael Palin.
Yes.
And two fascinating characters. People may remember there's this critic, former leftist turned Christian, Malcolm Muggeridge.
Malcolm Muggeridge, yes.
And Mervyn Stockwood, who was the Bishop of Southwark at the time.
Bishop of Southwark,
fascinating,
that's right.
Character. Say something about that. I mean, did this cause a stir? And was this one of the reasons why? Do you know anything about this?
It was. Well, what's interesting is that as I look closer at the film, I realize that other things got more people's attention besides this film. Now, this film did cause some controversy, but there was another proposed Danish film called The Sex Life of Jesus Christ, which people were much more in arms about and which never was produced. But just the idea that it could be produced got people a little stirred up. This interview was sort of a sandbag sort of interview. The Bishop of Southwark and Malcolm Muggeridge were there to make sure that they got all the right points in. In fact, one of them even mentioned the 30 pieces of silver that the Pythons got for making this film.
Right.
So there was this sort of smugness, frankly, on both sides during
true.
The interview. And so Cleese and Palin are both getting a little hot under the collar. And Muggeridge and the Bishop of Southwark seem very, 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 very smooth and very, very certain in
that this is blasphemy.
In their righteousness on the other side of it. So no one came off very attractively in that. Now, the film itself and that interview, yes, it contributed to some backlash, but not the fans still went to see the film.
Yeah.
It still made money. It was sort of a tempest in the teapot.
Yeah. Here's a moment, though. This is Michael Palin, and I think John Cleese comes in here, I guess, being somewhat defensive about whether or not this was an attack
right.
on religion.
I think that, and I've seen this in the sort of reviews of the film, they concentrate always on the religious angle. even you know, before they've seen it, they've decided this is a film about religion. I don't think it is entirely. I think that what we've chosen to do is what we've always done in Python. We've done for three series and done for three films. We have taken a certain group of people, which are generally sort of England in the present day, and put them into a historical context. I think that's what we've done with this film. I think it isn't entirely about religion. It's about the people who live in... anyone who lives and makes up our society today.
It's also about closed systems of thought, whether they're political or theological or religious, whatever. Systems by which whatever evidence is given to the person, he merely adapts it, fits it into his ideology. You show the same event to a Marxist and a Catholic, for example, they both of them fine, they both have explanations of it. I mean, it's what to be pompous poppers on about with falsifiability of theories. I mean, once you've actually got an idea that is whirring round so fast that no other light or contrary evidence can come in, then I think it's very dangerous. I don't think it's dangerous to someone like Malcolm, because he's actually a very nice man. But I think he is the sort of guy that this film is actually having a go at, because I don't think that there's any evidence that can come to him now that is going to make him rethink, think, am I right? Am I making a mistake?
Fascinating interview.
Don't you think? I love that explication of it, yes, by both of them. And it made me think it wasn't just a bunch of tittering, you know, satirists making fun of religion. They were thinking of closed philosophical systems. They were going after Marxists.
That's right.
They were going after the left, as well as the smug people on the right.
They do make fun of their own kind,
yeah,
if you will.
Yeah.
They have a good deal of fun doing that throughout Flying Circus and on into this film. I suppose it's only slightly disingenuous that they can say that this is really not about religion when they've decided to set it in a religious,
yeah,
setting,
yeah,
featuring religious characters. And, of course, Christ makes an appearance in at least one of the scenes in a very memorable kind of way.
Yeah.
Very doctrinal kind of way, but a very memorable kind of way.
Yeah.
So it's still – they're clearly not – if you read Palin's diaries, you get all sorts of behind-the-scenes ideas of what he was thinking. And there aren't any elements in there where he – or moments in there where he says, we are doing this to undercut – religion in general, we're doing this to undercut Christianity.
Yeah.
He actually over and over again says, we're trying to be as fair as possible and simply make a funny film. So they actually pull back and back and back, just like in Holy Grail, the original depiction of God was really nasty and much more in the film and much more unlikable. It would have made the film a much different film. They pulled back on that as the film moved forward. They did the same in Life of Brian.
That's interesting. So they start thinking about it about 76,
that's
I
right,
guess. What did they have in mind originally, and how does it start to transform as they're writing it?
It's said that Idle as a joke. This is when they were meeting just after Holy Grail has come out. And they're meeting, and he says, we need to make a film about – and we're going to call – well, about something important. And we're going to call it Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory. Which is a version, a take on the title of the Patton film as it was distributed in the UK. It was Patton, Lust for Glory.
Yeah.
And that was sort of a joke, and they thought, oh, that'd be funny. And as we heard earlier, the idea originally was to have Brian play Jesus. I mean, have Chapman play Jesus. Mm-hmm. And there would be like Ron the Baptist characters, and it would be a lot of silliness with Jesus in the center of the film. It didn't take them very long to move away from that and realize that their sort of métier, their sort of strength, if you will, as a writing team, wasn't that sort of spot on, let's make fun of this very this religious or this iconic character.
Yeah.
Let's go just off to the right. What's happening just over here?
Yeah, that's too on the nose.
Yeah, it's usually over here. This character over here that happens to get there 5 minutes late. So
right,
the first iteration of the film was, what if we have a character who arrives at the sermon 5 minutes too late? What if we have a character that arrives at the wine, the ceremony, the changing of the wine, water to wine sort of thing just after it's happened? So these moments of misunderstandings and too-latedness, that's where they started.
Let's talk about the three wise men scene, because that kind of gets us to this parody of the Jesus, baby Jesus story.
Right.
And how it there's kind of a twist on it, and how these three wise men have stumbled into the wrong manger, basically.
That's
we set
right,
this moment up for us, if you would.
We have the sort of standard. Everybody knows what to expect, of course. Now, it's important to know, I suppose, that just weeks or months earlier, we had a very celebrated Jesus of Nazareth miniseries, six-part miniseries.
This directed, is the Zeffirelli.
Yeah, directed by Franco Zeffirelli, yep, and starring all sorts of people. It's a lovely film, and it gets all sorts of viewership. And so it's this, that's the sort of understood way to tell the Christ story. And it's very sort, very like a Christmas card sort of story, yeah, storytelling.
Very glazy.
Absolutely.
The Jesus figure is lovely. And
I believe it's Robert Powell, Robert, and it, with,
yeah,
his beautiful blue eyes,
exactly,
that reviewers got lost in and commented on,
yeah,
over and over again.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason that, in fact, even in the script that they wrote out for Life of Brian, they're commenting on how a disciple should look at Brian. And it's just mimicking that sort of approach. So we see this scene, this three wise men scene, which frankly, up until a certain point, is kind of iconic and very recognizable. And there's the sheep. You can hear the sheep. There's the cow.
It's kind of
the
beautifully shot, too, we should say.
Of course it is. Just like in Holy Grail, these folks knew what they were doing. They'd grown up watching film. They had appreciated, for example, all sorts of classic film, but also art film. So they knew what they were doing. And they also knew that the better you set up the reality of the scene, the better it is to undercut it for comedic purposes. And so all the way up until the point where the mother of Brian falls off the stool, when they startle her, we're thinking maybe this is a straight-ahead approach. But we know after that, nothing's going to be the same.
So you're astrologers, are you? Well, what is he then? Hmm? What star sign is he?
Capricorn.
Capricorn, eh? What are they like?
He's the son of God, our Messiah, king of the Jews.
That's Capricorn, is it?
No, that's just him.
Oh, I was going to say, otherwise there'd be a lot of them.
By what name are you calling him?
Brian.
We worship you, O'Brien, who are Lord over us all. Praise unto you, Brian. And to the Lord our Father. Amen.
Do you do a lot of this, then?
What?
This praising.
No.
If you're dropping by again, do pop in. And thanks a lot for the gold and frankincense. But don't worry too much about the myrrh next time, all right? Thank you. Goodbye.
It's hard not to laugh it hysterically
is.
At this stuff.
It's still fun.
It's still fun, and then, of course, we don't see this because it's hard to reflect this on radio. Then they come back just shortly after when they realize they've gotten the wrong.
They immediately come back to get their gifts back and then realize that the actual nativity scene is just across the way, which is a terrific moment. And if you look at that nativity scene, you realize that it could be out of any perfect production,
totally,
any tableau that you'd,
yeah,
see,
yeah,
in front of any church or mystery play or whatever it happens to be. So that's very iconic and treated actually quite reverently, that scene.
Quite.
Which is very interesting. And so they're actually setting up that scene and keeping a distance from the actual story,
yeah,
of Christ and the actual nativity and telling us, nope, the story we're telling is over here with Brian and Mandy.
What is it Mandy's, Brian's mom?
only named in the script.
Exactly. Right. I was going to say,
no name,
we don't know that.
That's right.
What does it mean that – is this a theme, I'm wondering, for the Pythons, that he's an accident. He was the wrong person at the wrong time. He's just shortly off that – because this seems like this comes up later when the timing is off, when there's a miscommunication. I mean, that seems to be part of the idea of the film in some way.
It is. And it is probably Pythonist, the idea that you're not going to follow – if you're going to follow a titular hero or a well-known character, the path is going to be circuitous and full of sideways routes. We saw that in Holy Grail. In this one, Brian is going to be a worker, he's going to be a wannabe lover, he's going to be a reluctant hero of all in all stripes. But at no point is he absolutely certain what he is. I suppose accepting in his moment with Judith just prior to his mother discovering them, and then we have this sort of transition from Brian as Brian and being able to live his own life to Brian as Savior. And then he has the moment on the balcony. And then he has, of course, he becomes for other people a messianic figure, something that he does not want. But that is much more like a Python hero than just a straight ahead kind of hero.
Let's play that moment on the balcony. Would you set this up for us? Because it's such a wise thing that he's saying. Now, set this up in the sense that, I mean, he's being followed by masses. They're constantly following him because they have a misimpression of who he might be.
Right. I don't even know if it's that they have a misimpression of who he might be. I think they
They're looking for someone to follow.
They're willing to follow anyone.
Right.
That's right.
That's
in fact, later we have one character who says, I should know about saviors. I've followed a few.
Right.
And so they are there because Brian is the latest thing. He's the latest ism. He's the latest, you know, in the United States, they would have been called, I suppose, Jesus freaks in the early 1970s. But in this scene, he is simply opening up, and he's opening up a window. He's just the happiest that he's been because Judith is his, and you can hear the sounds of the morning. It just sounds like a beautiful, beautiful day. And then he opens up the window, and there are hundreds of people waiting down there to worship in. And of course, he's fully naked and fully unashamed, at least as an actor. But the character is ashamed and wonders why they're there. But this is his first introduction into being a messianic figure. Doesn't like it very much, and they especially don't like his message when he doesn't give them what they want. He does not say, I'm going to lead you. He essentially tells them, you need to lead yourself.
Please, 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 listen. I've got one or two things to say.
Tell us all of them.
Look, you've got it all wrong. You don't need to follow me. You don't need to follow anybody. You've got to think for yourselves. You're all individuals.
Yes, we're all individuals.
You're all different.
Yes, we are all different.
I'm not. You all got to work it out for yourselves.
Yes, we've got to work it out for ourselves.
Exactly. Don't let anyone tell you what to do. Otherwise,
that's enough.
Ooh, that wasn't a minute.
Oh, yes, it was.
Oh, no, it wasn't.
Now, stop that. Go away.
I think I call that the panto scene because for a British viewer, that's going to mean a lot more, frankly, than it probably does to an American viewer. But that's right out of the pantomime world, the Puss in Boots sort of world where the principal boy can lead the audience and they repeat things. They know what to say. That would have been instantly recognizable on a different level for a British audience. But for us, of course, we look at it and see, all right, these are people who clearly want to be led. They want to think on their own as long as someone else tells them what they're supposed to be thinking.
Yeah. Here's John Cleese in that same debate talking about this particular moment. And for him, I think this idea was really important.
What were we trying to do? I think it comes out, it was spelled out perhaps rather too plainly, rather too banally at one point, when he says, make up your own mind, don't let other people tell you. And we would absolutely deny, at least I would, that there was any attempt to say you should not believe in Christ. What we're saying is take a critical view, find out about it, don't just believe because somebody tells you to. Somebody in the pulpit says something, question it, work it out yourself.
You're seriously suggesting that if someone saw that film, say a young kid who knew nothing about the Gospels or about history, that the figure of Christ that would emerge from it, this story of the Incarnation, would be a noble one, would be...
He would have to sort it out for himself.
And you feel...
he would have to, for example, work out, I mean, does one accept every word in the Bible? In a Sermon on the Mount, did they get it all right when Mark wrote it down 30 years later? Well, I mean, was it...
I think he was probably a little less reactionary than some of the others at that point, and he was actually responding to that's not necessarily anti-religion. I don't get that feeling, but certainly that idea that someone else should have this control over information or appropriate information or acceptable information, especially when it comes to large groups of people and belief. And he felt that it was much better if people were going to make up their own minds. And in fact, as he said, they make fun of it in the Sermon on the Mount scene where they say, are you certain that's what was said? Somebody said Greek or did somebody say meek and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a miscommunication. That, of course, is a trope for the Pythons.
Absolutely. Darrell Larson is with us, professor in the Media Arts Department at the Center for Animation at Brigham Young University. His latest book is called A Book About the Film Monty Python's Life of Brian, all the references from Assyrians to Zeffirelli. And you can actually see Life of Brian on the big screen tomorrow, Cinemark Theaters is going to be showing it. There are screenings at 2 and 7. If you're coming to our screening of our documentary, that's at 7, you might want to skip that one and go to the 2 o'clock one. We have details about all of that wherever you decide to go on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Monty Python's Life of Brian because there's an expert on the Pythons here in Utah, film scholar Daryl Larson, who has a new book. It's called A Book About the Film Monty Python's Life of Brian, all the references from Assyrians to Zeffirelli. He's joining us here in the studio to talk about it. There's a scene I want to play, a moment from the film. And this to me really seemed to get at the kind of vague idea of preachers and prophets of the time. It's the scene in the marketplace, and Brian is sort of sampling all of these different we end up with a Michael Palin figure. I'm not sure he has a name, but would you say something about this moment? Because this seems indicative of what they were sending up to.
There's actually five prophets there, and we only hear from three of them. The first one's called the Blood and Thunder Prophet in the script, and he's the one that's McKeon, who's just ranting and raving about right out of Revelations. Yeah.
Loves to get naked in the Python films.
Yeah, that's Terry Gilliam, right?
Oh, that's Gilliam. That's
Gilliam.
Right.
Then there's the false prophet. There's the Blood and Thunder prophet. Then there's the false prophet. Right. And then there's the boring prophet. And Palin plays the boring prophet. And it's actually just a simple sampling of probably the kinds of prophetic utterances that, frankly, people in Jerusalem would have heard on a fairly regular basis. A John the Baptist type of person that was ignored by most people and considered a crackpot. In fact, Gilliam's version of the prophet, covered in mud and looking like he'd just come down from the mountains after eating locusts and honey, that's probably closer to the John the Baptist sort of prophet that people would have encountered in first century Judea. But also this has a contemporary version or contemporary iteration where, you know, right outside Parliament, there was and still is a place where anyone can set up and speak and have a demonstration. And every kind of person you can imagine was up there bewailing the state of the world and the state of the British Empire and the fallenness of everything around them. So this is something, again, from first century Judea, but also from 1977 Great Britain.
And the visage shall be huge and black, and the eyes thereof red with the blood of living creatures. And the whore of Babylon shall ride forth on a free-headed serpent, and throughout the land shall be a great rubbing of pots.
The demon shall bear a nine-bladed sword. Nine-bladed, not two or five or seven, but nine, which he will wield on all wretched sinners just like you, sir, there. And the horn shall be on the head.
Hebadiah, his servant, there shall in that time be rumors of things going astray, and there shall be a great confusion as to where things really are. And nobody will really know where lieth those little things with the sort of raffia work base that has an attachment. At this time, a friend shall lose his friend's hammer, and the young shall not know where lieth the things possessed by their fathers that their fathers put there only just the night before, about 8 o'clock.
So Brian will join them later and try and do his best. But, of course, he's borrowing from what obviously he's heard Jesus say, so he does his own version of the Beatitudes.
Yeah. The Beatitudes. What do you want to say about this moment? I want to play a bit of this. This is really fascinating because I have to say, on some level, you get a sense of maybe what it would have been like if you were a Bronze Age peasant listening to this itinerant rabbi preaching.
That's right.
Couldn't maybe hear it all, wondering what the message might have been. And when you set this moment up for us, this is kind of great.
This is the other almost reverent and iconic moment in the film. There are two instances of actual references to Christ. The first is the nativity where we saw from a distance and it was a perfect looking nativity and never undercut. This is the second one. It's Ken Colley who's playing Jesus on the hill giving this the sermon, who interestingly the next year would be a bad guy in Empire Strikes Back and then Return of the Jedi.
Is that
kind
right?
of fascinating.
Wow.
But he is delivering these in a very straight ahead kind of way. He is speaking to people around him in a very respectful way, and they're dressed in period dress, and there's a few Roman soldiers around. And as the camera pulls back, visually, it's a borrow from films like Jesus Christ Superstar and King of Kings, where they all have this scene in it.
Yeah.
And the camera pulls back to reveal that far, far back are the folk that are having a hard time hearing. And maybe the word's being passed along to them. Maybe they're trying to just craning to hear. But it's totally understandable that someone way up front says, he said, blessed are the what? And it sounds like the Greek. And so it's not the meek, it's the Greek. And then they have an argument about what that means. That actually makes total sense. But it begins as a very, very, very reverent and almost sacramental kind of moment.
Yeah.
Leave it alone. Give it a rest.
Do you mind? I can't hear a word he's saying.
Don't you do you mind me? I was talking to my husband.
Well, go and talk to him somewhere else. I can't hear a bloody thing.
Don't you swear at my wife.
I was only asking him to shut up so he can hear what he's saying, big nose.
Don't you call my husband big nose.
Well, he has got a big nose.
Could you be quiet, please?
What was that? I don't know. I was too busy talking to big nose.
I think it was blessed are the cheesemakers.
What's so special about the cheesemakers?
Well, obviously, it's not meant to be taken literally. It refers to any manufacturers of dairy products.
See, if you haven't been going on, we'd have heard that, big nose.
Hey, say that once more, I'll smash your bloody face in.
Better keep listening. Might be a bit about blessed are the big noses.
Oh, lay off him.
Oh, you're not so bad yourself, conk face. Where are you two from, Nose City?
And don't pick your nose.
I wasn't going to pick my nose. I'm going to thump him.
You hear that? Blessed are the Greek. The Greek.
Mm. Well, apparently he's going to inherit the earth. Did anyone catch his name?
You're not going to thump anybody.
I'll thump him if he calls me Big Nose again.
Oh, shut up, Big Nose.
Huh? What? I warned you. I really will slug you so
hard. Oh, it's the meek. Blessed are the meek. Oh, that's nice, isn't it? I'm glad they're getting something because they had a hell of a time.
Oh, you know what's great about this? And also, I'm wondering, what do you make about the references to the big noses? I mean, this was clearly a reference to sort of Jewish caricatures, right?
Sure. But also Roman caricatures, the idea
of
the aquiline sort of feature, that large nose. It's also very middle school kind of.
Totally.
These guys often go back to, you know, their fifth form selves. They're 13, 14, 15-year-olds, wherever they happen to be. And the things that were funny then are still funny now. And so the easiest way to identify a difference in someone else is that physical difference. And in this case, it works on a couple of levels. Yes, the Jewish references, because the people there are both Jewish, of Jewish, different Jewish extractions, Samaritans, that sort of thing. But also there's Romans there. And it's kind of funny. The folks he's calling Big Nose actually have noses that are no bigger than his.
No,
so it's certainly not based on the actual actors or anything else. This is just one of those wonderful scenes where in the Python world, miscommunication is huge, misunderstanding. And that's a borrow, right? Comic misunderstanding has been with us since, you know, English Renaissance drama, for example. Shakespeare did it all the time. Ben Jonson did it all the way up through Sheridan and Fielding and others. We still see that idea of misunderstanding something will actually fuel the rest of the play, and it has to be resolved much, much later. The Pythons are adept at that.
And how they use the language of what would have been this nation of shopkeepers.
Right.
This was not – I mean, there's a bit of posh British accent there, but yep. It's mostly these are the guys on the ground.
That's right. These are boots on the ground types. These are real people. For those who had grown up watching the mystery plays and going to see some of those plays, most of those or many of those were performed with regional accents. And so you have broad Yorkshire types, broad northern accents performing the nativity scene and performing these kinds of things in very straight ahead and very sacred and very appreciated kinds of ways. So for a lot of the British audience, it wouldn't necessarily have been as odd to hear the Gwen Taylor character, Mrs. Big Nose, and her sort of Cockney-ish accent there, her rough accent, or others' rough accents in that place. They would have been actually fairly used to that. American audiences would have had probably a little bit more fun hearing those.
Yeah. So let's talk about one of the social and political, and one of the elements of political and social context for the film. You say in the book that they, the, the pythons. And you heard Michael Palin say this earlier. They wanted to study, you wanted to study the book in its time. Palin wanted to make a commentary about Britain of its time, right. Set it in another context, but, you know, a historical event, but set it in its time. The Middle East, let's talk about what's going on there. Palestine, as you had pointed out in your book, had been administered by Britain since the end of World War I. It had become a base for these, think about the late 70s now, what's going on. A number of terror organizations are setting up shop in Palestine. There's this ongoing, obviously, dispute that hasn't been resolved yet between Israel and Palestinians. There were refugee camps. And then there were these acronym names that started to crop up that they take care, you know, the PLO, the SLA, and
the American
version of it, and others. Talk about this as a setting.
The world, the PFJ comes from a couple of places. That's the People's Front of Judea.
Right. I think most people knew that, by the way, but keep going.
They seem to forget at some point.
That's right.
The PFJ comes from a couple of places. Number one, of course, all those acronyms. But number two, there's a movie called I'm All Right, Jack, which is a Peter Sellers film from 1959, which most people haven't seen, but which is very funny and very well done. It is actually about trade union work and about a shop steward played by Peter Sellers who has a constant battle with leadership. And the PFJ is actually styled directly on that group of shop stewards. In fact, there's a scene where they're marching to save Brian from the cross that is borrowed, I mean, is directly, almost shot for shot, from the film I'm All Right, Jack. Now, nobody ever says this out loud. None of the pythons say, by the way, we're homaging this film.
Yeah.
But it is very clear when you look at it. The film, Brian, doesn't exist in the way it exists without it. And so they're borrowing from that. So that takes the edge off their PFJ. Their PFJ is silly. Their PFJ will not accomplish anything, and we know that. They're not going to plant a bomb. They're not going to kidnap anybody. Even if they say they're going to take Pilate's wife and cut her bits off and send it back, they're not going to do that. They are safe. By the end of the film, they're back where they're most safe, and that's talking to each other as opposed to being out doing action. Brian suffered for them.
Yeah.
But the world of the 1970s, of course, we see an incredible increase in hijackings. We see an incredible increase in kidnappings for ransom. You know, the scion of the Getty family was kidnapped in, what, 73, I believe, and a bit of him was sent back as evidence that they had him, and he was eventually ransomed. Paintings, Vermeer paintings were being kidnapped, and bits of that, those were being sent back, and those were being ransomed. Patty Hearst, the first demand from SLA was that the Hearst family feed all the poor in the Bay Area. Yeah. That's what they wanted.
Outrageous. They kind of did for a...
And they did. He started feeding people. He really did. So it's kind of this fascinating mix of effective, ineffective, silly, but not so silly because they're actually doing some rather serious things and sometimes for some serious motives. But you could not read a newspaper of the day without encountering these acronyms over and over again.
This moment is sort of this hysterical take where you have the PFJ gathering together, and they have this as these groups, they're discontent with the colonial rule of the Romans and wondering what it is that the Romans did for them. You want to say something about this moment? Because there's seem to be plenty that the Romans actually had done for civilization.
It's a classic scene, of course. But it really does come from somewhere. Just a little before this film was written, there was a documentary series created called The British Empire, and all sorts of academics contributed to it. And they were throwing rocks at the British Empire is what they were doing. And here's how the British Empire did this wrong and this wrong and this wrong and enslaved these peoples and made people's lives worse. And there was this immediate reaction by people who supported the British Empire, even though it's essentially gone away by this point, but supported it, saying, no, we did this and this and this. And one letter writer even created a list, which is almost precisely the list that John Cleese will give us in this scene for what the British Empire did that was right. And most of it, you can't argue with it because they actually did build roads and dams, and they actually even built an aqueduct, a water supply into Jerusalem after World War I, something that they desperately needed. And so it was certainly a part of what was actually happening after World War I and certainly in the lives of the pythons.
They bled us white, the bastards. They take everything we had. And not just from us, from our fathers and from our fathers' fathers.
And from our fathers' fathers' fathers.
Yeah.
And from our fathers' 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 fathers.
You're right, Stan. Don't labor the point. And what have they ever given us in return?
The aqueduct?
What?
The aqueduct.
Oh, yeah, yeah, they did give us that. That's true, yeah.
And the sanitation.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation, Reg. Remember what the city used to be like?
Yeah, all right, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things the Romans have done.
And the roads.
Well, yeah, obviously yeah. The roads. I mean, the roads go without sand, don't they? But apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation. Medicine. Mm-hmm. Education.
Yeah, yeah, all right, fair enough.
And the wine.
Yeah, yeah, that's something we've really missed, Reg, if the Romans left.
Public baths.
And it's safe to walk in the streets at night now, Reg.
Yeah, they certainly know how to keep order. Let's face it, the only ones who could in a place like this.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace?
Oh, peace! Shut up!
Pax Romana.
That is the Cleese character's standard response when he's flustered. Just right. Shut up. We got to move on to something else. That could have been a list of what Britain assumed they'd done, for example, in India,
right
for a number of years.
Well, that's the subtext, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They were, for years, in fact, at least since the 1897 Victoria's Jubilee, the high point of sort of the muscular version of the empire. We'd seen comparisons between the Roman Empire at its glory and at its height and the British Empire for what it was bringing to the world. So over and over again, you know, scholars and presenters and all sorts of people were saying what the Romans did right then, we are doing right and better now. So actually the Pythons are merely echoing what they've heard, probably right in their schoolwork from their textbooks as they grew up.
Darrell Larson, professor in the Media Arts Department in the Center for Animation at Brigham Young University. His new book is called A Book About the Film Monty Python's Life of Brian, all the references from Assyrians to Zeffirelli. And you can actually see Life of Brian on the big screen this week. Tomorrow, Cinemark Theaters is going to be showing it. There are screenings at 2 and 7. If you're coming to our screening of our documentary, that's at 7. You might want to skip that one and go to the 2 o'clock one. We have details about all of that. Wherever you decide to go on our website, radiowest.org. We'll come back in just a moment with some final thoughts and a few more scenes. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Monty Python's Life of Brian with the film scholar Darrell Larson, who's written a book about the film. In fact, the book is called A Book About the Film, Monty Python's Life of Brian, all the references from Assyrians to Zeffirelli. There's a screening, by the way. You can watch Life of Brian on the big screen at Cinemark Theaters tomorrow. We'll give you details on our website. We can talk about that a little bit later. All right, so this is interesting. We were talking off the air, one of my favorite scenes, and you say what you think might be one of the most complete scenes
right.
in Life of Brian is the scene of the stoning.
The stoning.
And I'm thinking most people kind of know this. What I like about it is kind of the biting take it has on orthodoxy. Set this up for us. Let's talk about this moment.
It's modeled directly after the scene, the stoning scene. In fact, it's shot in precisely the same location as the scene from Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth.
Really?
Same wall and partial. They built a partial wall also behind it. And they put rocks there that people could pick up, and they call it the stoning place. And so they are using that well-known, again, that had just premiered, you know, months before. People would have recognized it, very iconic sort of setting. And again, it is set up to be to show you the sort of ridiculousness of this fascination with perhaps a single word, or an utterance, a point of view. Anything can turn at any point. In Holy Grail, of course, it was the bridge keeper who was in total charge of his world until he got flustered and said the wrong thing, and he got thrown into the gorge. And that's the Python world. In this case, the only representative of the order that we see in the film is the Cleese character, who's some sort of priest or high priest, not even given a name. He's just the officiator. And he's fine up until he realizes that just that word, uttering that word, which is Jehovah, will lead to all sorts of things that he never considered. Okay, that it's a fascinating scene.
Matthias, son of Deuteronomy of Gath,
Yes.
You have been found guilty by the elders of the town of uttering the name of our Lord, and so as a blasphemer, you are to be stoned to death.
Look, I'd had a lovely supper, and all I said to my wife was that piece of halibut was good enough for Jehovah.
Blasphemy! He said it again! Did you hear him? Are there any women here today? Very well. By virtue of the authority vested in me.
Oh, lay off. We haven't started yet.
Come on. Who threw that? Who threw that stone? Come on. Sorry, I thought
we started.
Go to the back. Oh, dear. Always one, isn't there? Now, where were we?
Look, I don't think it ought to be blasphemy. Just saying Jehovah.
You're only making it worse for yourself.
Making it worse? How could it be worse? Jehovah!
I'm warning you, if you say Jehovah once more... Right, who threw that? Come on, who threw that? Was it you?
Yes.
Right.
Well, you did say Jehovah.
It works as radio, doesn't it?
It sure does. This is music hall stuff. This is the Goon Show influence that the Pythons had throughout their careers.
Let's talk about how. What was the reaction? It seems to the film. When it comes out. I mean, we have this, you know, television show where people are debating whether or not it's blasphemy, those kinds of things.
Right.
But was it all that controversial?
It was. Well, it was at a certain level. People like Mary Whitehouse, who had an organization called the National Viewer and Listeners Association, a powerful conservative action group that was looking at media at the time. And she had been instrumental in, for example, taking the publication The Gay News to court in 77 and getting an obscenity trial accomplished for publishing a poem that depicted things that were upsetting to more conservative audiences. And she had threatened to do the same thing, and the Pythons were thinking, are we going to be in trouble here? Or is she going to sue us? Are they going to say heresy? People are saying that it was a heretical film.
Yeah.
But of course, the cooler heads were saying, well, heresy, you know, it's hard. That's going to be hard to prove in a court of law. And most judges won't be interested in taking that on anyway. And if you're a member of the faith, then you really have to worry about heretical kinds of charges. There were protests outside theaters, a few of them. There were meetings like the one that we saw that was recorded. But overall, I think what we see is that with the sort of expansion of what was allowable on screen and the fact that the Pythons clearly weren't going for a youth audience, they clearly wanted the adult rating. Most of them argued for the nudity so they could keep that adult rating and keep kids out of the show.
There's a little bit of full frontal nudity in that film.
That's right, which of course they knew in the United States would be an automatic R rating.
Yep.
And they were okay with that. They didn't want to take that out to make sure. They wanted a more mature audience. Yeah. So they were ready to fight it. Palin says in his diaries that they're ready to go to court if needed because they'd just seen this series of other court actions which had gone against those kinds of depictions. But what's probably saved them was the fact that they stayed away. It was an early decision, but they stayed away from depicting Christ in any kind of complicated or challenging situation. The two times that the Jesus figure shows up, both are treated very reverentially, and then we move away from that to see what silliness is going on elsewhere. I think that was probably what kept them from any serious sort of repercussions.
Well, we have to talk finally about always look on the bright side of life. How did this come about? And the setting for it, of course, as you all know, or should know, is all these various figures on crosses being crucified. And Eric Idle takes up this the song.
That's right. Yeah. There's 140 people that they had to crucify on a special Passover crucifixion they were celebrating. Idol, of course, is a songwriter. And, you know, it's his idea to do Spamalot because he saw lots of potential for that. He wrote songs throughout the series. This song is actually, it's kind of fun to realize where this song comes from. Watch the film. Let's see, what's the film called now? It's a Vera Lynn film. The movie's called We'll Meet Again. It's from 1943. It is a film written and a song written for the British folk who are living in London through World War II. And the lyrics are kind of telling. If you read the lyrics of Look on the Bright Side of Life and then you read Vera Lynn's lyrics, you see, for example, she says, "Tell that umbrella man he's just also ran. Think of a kid on a swing. When you're up to your neck in hot water, be like the kettle and sing." Yeah. It's too close to Look on the Bright Side of Life to be an accident. So what this really is Idol being the entertainer in the tube, let's say, during the war, down below where people are hiding during the air raid. And he's saying just what they did during this period. Let's sing and make things better. And tomorrow will be a good day. And we're going to survive the night. It's kind of fascinating that he's going back to when all of them were young and they all did live through this for this closing moment to say, hey, you think it's bad? Well, it's OK. There is tomorrow. Now, we might not be alive, but there is a tomorrow. Things are going to be good. That's where the song comes from.
Cheer up, Brian. You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life.
Daryl Larson. His book is a book about the film Monty Python's Life of Brian. All the references from Assyrians to Zeffirelli. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can see Life of Brian at the Cinemark Theaters tomorrow. Go to our website for the details, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. Our thanks to Michael Havey as well. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Always look on the right side of life. For life is quite absurd.